It's about average. Let's see, I've got the statistics right here. In 2013,
we were at 1.6
and 1.7. 82.
Senate will come to order. Messages from the House.
From the House of Representatives, January 25, 2017. Message number 163. Mr. President, the bill which follows failed to pass the House, third reading by the vote indicated. House Bill number 77, In-State Tuition, AmeriCorps Service. Ayes 30, noes 28, excused 2. Message number 156. Mr. President, the following bills passed the House on third reading in an amended form by the votes indicated. House Bill number 87, Return of Victims' Property Held as Evidence, ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 93, Wichee Repayment Program, Veterinary Medicine Students, ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 101, School Districts, Veterans Employment Preference, ayes 48, noes 10, excused 2. House Bill number 119, Senior Citizens Districts Use of Revenues, ayes 58, excused 2. House Bill number 37, Teacher Accountability, ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. House Bill number 62, Immunity for Drug Overdose Reporting, ayes 50, noes 8, excused 2. House Bill number 112, EMS Licensure Interstate Compact, ayes 45, noes 13, excused 2. Mr. President, the following bills passed the House on third reading by the votes indicated. House Bill number 23, Secretary of State's Office Amendments, ayes 55, noes 3, excused 2. Message number 160, House Bill number 126, Elementary School Foreign Language Requirement, ayes 56, noes 2, excused 2. Wendy Harding, House Chief Clerk.
Just for the information of members of the Senate, and of course we passed noon today for any Senate files or joint resolutions to be submitted, we have Senate files 2 through 172 and Senate joint resolutions 1 through 9. Total of about 181 different pieces of proposed legislation. Just for your information, in 2013, we were at 164, 2015, 146, so we're a little more aggressive, but well within the range of where we think we would have been and when we started approaching this session. Anyway, with that introduction, reference and reading of bills, Senate File 143, first reading of the Senate File.
Senate File 143, Child Health Insurance Program Management, sponsored by Senator Scott.
Senate File 143 will be referred to Committee Number 12, Rules. Senate File 147, first reading of the Senate File.
Senate File 147, Livestock Inspection and Investigators, sponsored by the Appropriations Committee.
Senate File 147, we refer to Committee Number 5, Agriculture. Reports from standing committees.
January 25, 2017, Mr. Presidential Committee Number 2, to whom was referred Senate File 136, Energy Science Stipends and Fellowships, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll, Hastert, and Landon. Senator Burns, Chairman. Mr. President, your committee number 2, to whom was referred Senate File 49, Investment Funds Committee, respectfully reports same back to the Senate with a recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll, Hastert, and Landon. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we are at that business, order of business, to recommitting ourselves to committee hold. Do you have a motion?
Mr. President, I do have a motion. Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into committee of the whole.
Heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion carries. Senator Bouchard. Where's your pillow? Huh? Where's your water? We got water for you? What else do you need?
Start.
You still come to order. You still say we'll come to order.
We don't say the first, though. We say the next.
Whatever.
Doesn't matter.
Okay.
The committee of the whole will please come to order. The next bill for consideration is Senate File 16. The reading clerk will read the Senate file.
Senate File 16, Special Districts Elections, an Act Relating to Special Districts, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, was referred to Committee Number 7, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Agar, Case, Nethercott, Pappas. No, Senator Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 16, Special District Elections. Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it amends the election laws of the specified special district elections to create more uniformity between different types of district elections, and it also has the extra that it allows a fire protection district to be initially formed with 5 members if the district meets certain size requirements. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I think we'd be well advised to read it in at this time.
Senate File 16, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 9.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 16, and I'd like to keep it close by, and we'll address it as we work through the bill. Mr. Chairman, again, this is another product of the Special Districts Task Force, and this one was heavily worked on by the county clerks, especially the county clerk from Fremont County, and it's an attempt to really make the special districts elections more uniform throughout the code, which will help, we think it will help public participation, it will help public to understand and participate in these elections, and it, the idea of uniformity is good. So if you turn the page and we're under 2229103, it's about the applicability. Lines 1 and 2 on page 2, it says this Act applies to the following districts as specified in subsection B. That's the same list that we saw earlier. It's not in your bill because that's language, and it's also covered by the other bill. But you'll also see that there's a addition to that section that talks about fire protection districts, including county commissioner fire protection districts. You may not know this, but there are 2 types of fire protection districts, and you're going to learn all about them. You'll be so excited. But one is a one that's created by the county commissioners, and another one is one that's created by, the formation of a district. So you'll learn about that. And you can see this is actually a pretty simple bill all in all. Page 2, 2229110, you can see that we're dealing here with, I remember what kind of a district I've got here. But it makes it compliant with the election law by changing not more than 50 days to not more than 100 and 1 days and not less than 90 days before the organizational election, the county clerk shall publish. And that's what that deals with. And right? And then you can see on the next page, there's another publication requirement, not more than, it used to be 39 days. The clerks say we need not more than 90 days and not less than 70 days before the formation election. Candidates may file an application for election in the office of the county clerk. And I can't remember what district this applies to or if it applies to more, so I'm going to need to check that. But if we go to page 4, you can see that we're dealing with the establishment of a hospital district under 352401, and it says a special hospital district, the old language was, may be created in subsequent district elections held through the following procedure. This makes it uniform and says a special hospital district may be established in subsequent elections held under the procedures for petitioning, hearing, and electing of special districts as set forth in the Special District Elections Act of 1994. The next section, Mr. Chairman, deals with fire protection districts. There's a little bit of subtlety going on here because, and by the way, this is 359202. This is the type of fire protection district I got to figure out which kind that is, but give me a moment. What this has to do with is whether there are 3 board members or 5 board members. Current law allows for districts to be formed only with 3 board members. But if you have assets or valuation of a certain size, and I believe it's $3 million, Mr. Chairman, that you can actually evolve your district in having 5 commissioners or 5 board members. So what this amendment does is allow that to that type of district to have 5 board members starting off the bat. And that's what it does, and that's why you can say the language on lines 18 through 20 is either 3 or 5 members to accommodate both types. Mr. Chairman, that's the initial election, and you can see the language at the top of page 5. The changes there are about subsequent elections. Another thing about fire protection districts, Mr. Chairman, you probably didn't know this, but it's very exciting, is that they have the ability to divide the districts into divide the district into board member districts. Now, isn't it so that they can have the board may provide for district directors to be appointed at any combination of single member, multi member, or at large representation from the sub-districts. You can see on page 6. Part E, the Board of County Commissioners may provide for the election of the initial Board of Directors with 5 members if the assessed valuation of the property of the district exceeds $3 million. You guys didn't think I knew that, did you? At the time the district is formed. 359210, this is your fire protection district that is formed independent of the county. And 359211 on page 7 is the formation of county commission fire districts. You can see it's mostly about notice and for the formation in the elections. And, Mr. Chairman, I might add that the county commission fire districts can only be used in unincorporated areas of the county. And you can see on page 8, again, it's about notice being at least 30 days. And finally, at the end of the bill, we have the deal about the pursuant to the assessed property valuation requirements, the board may have either 3 or 5 members. Now we're at the point where the amendment would track in, Mr. Chairman, and I would ask you to turn to the amendment. It deals with a watershed improvement district. And this actually deals with the terms of a watershed improvement district, both in the initial election and the subsequent elections. So the old language had a maximum of 3-year terms. They were divided up between the board of directors. It's kind of hard to read here. It says the first board of directors shall determine by lot from among its membership 2 members to serve terms of 1 year. I'm trying to read the old language. 2 members to serve terms of 2 years and 1 member to serve a term of 3 years. That was the old language. New language proposed both for the initial, and we're going to talk about it for the subsequent in the amendment, is the first board of directors shall determine by lot from among its memberships 3 members to serve terms of 4 years and 2 members to serve terms of 2 years. So it's a 3-2 split, and we don't have it's, it makes it less complicated, a little bit more continuity. And, Mr. Chairman, you can see that similar language for Board of Directors of Districts, Watershed Improvement Districts, Mr. Chairman, on line 24 that existed prior to the enactment of this bill. That's the amendment. I'd be happy to discuss any questions on the amendment. Appreciate any help if anybody wants to throw me any, if I missed anything.
Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 16, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed, say no. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 16 is passed. We're back on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 16, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 16 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 18. Will the Secretary read it in, please?
Senate File 18, Special District Public Records, BOCES, an act relating to special districts, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, was referred to Committee Number 7, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Agar, Case, Nethercott, Pappas, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 18, Special District Public Records, BOCES. I'm afraid I saved the very longest bill for last. This will probably take 20 or 30 minutes. But actually, this is the good one, Mr. Chairman. This bill removes the Board of Cooperative Education Services from the list of special districts that we talked about a couple of times here. So Boards of Cooperative Educational Services, or BOCES, would no longer be required to comply with certain special district reporting requirements, Mr. Chairman, but the testimony in the task force and the testimony at interim corporations as well as corporations this session, Mr. Chairman, was that since these Boards of Cooperative Education are kind of a intermingled joining of school districts and community colleges, that they are already covered under the reporting requirements of both entities. They don't have the independent ability to assess mill levies. The mill levies come under the requirements of the school districts. And, Mr. Chairman, the members are appointed by the school districts. So we actually have the ability to have all the information that we've talked about, needing all the budget things. And so it was felt that it was unnecessary for them to have a subsequent level of reporting that was very duplicative. I've noticed in the emails that some people kind of got this backwards when they're calling. They're sending emails saying, please don't put BOCES into the special district requirements. Well, what this bill actually does is they're saying, don't make BOCES special districts. What this bill does is actually take BOCES out of being special districts, and I assure you that these folks are very delighted to have this done. It's time for questions.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 18, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Senate File 18 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 82. The clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 82, Graduation Requirement CPR, an act relating to education, sponsored by Senator Landon. It was referred to committee number 2, which returned a committee recommendation that it return without recommendation. Ayes, Senators Burns, Dockstader, Driscoll, Landon, excused, Senator Hastert. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Cove.
Move that the Committee of the Whole Rise report do so with due pass recommendation on Senate File 82. Defer to Senator Landon. There is a second motion as well, but I'll defer to Senator Landon for an explanation of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. By way of explanation, I might, first of all, on behalf of the Chairman of Appropriations, help the rest of the body know that we took up the bill in appropriations and discovered that it really had no fiscal impact, and so that's why there was no recommendation from that committee, Mr. Chairman, no fiscal impact on this bill. This is a bill that, at the risk of overstating, I think it has a chance to be transformative. I think it can help us to change some culture out there. You may have heard a little bit about this bill, and sometimes it helps for you to know why I brought it. And so I just want to share a couple of stories that I did with the committee. These are from the heart, so to speak. I, as you know, in my previous line of work, I part of my duties were to serve as an athletic director. And not long after I was hired for that duty, I went up to visit the rodeo team. At that time, the rodeo team, of course, was practicing every day. They were going to the arena. They were riding bucking horses and jumping off on steers and doing what they do. I quickly understood and found out that they had no equipment out there, nothing, no AEDs or anything. Well, I went to work and got one of those donated. And one night at a meeting that they held, I went up to the agriculture building and I brought that with me. And I came into 55 of these student athletes sitting there. And I said, how many know what this is? And about three or four of them raised their hands. And I said, how many of you know how to do CPR? And a couple of them raised their hands out of 55. I think they were our nursing students. I know one of them, one of our barrel racers, was a nursing student, so she knew how to do it. And I was mortified by that. I actually thought, my goodness, these are student athletes in a very dangerous competitive environment going out there every day and doing what they do, and they had no idea what I was talking about. We quickly tried to figure out how to get them some training. The other thing that kind of compelled me to look into this legislation happened last summer. We lost a friend who was a teacher at one of the high schools in Casper last year at the lake outside of Casper. We were standing around that day on a different side of the lake, but several of us adults standing there. And a couple said to me, they said, you know, if they would have pulled that gentleman out of the lake right in front of me, I'm not sure I would have known what to do. And I thought, you know, that certainly, Mr. Chairman, that's not good enough. I really think that as we learn and know new things, we ought to expect out of ourselves that we turn out perhaps graduates who know how to do this. And so shortly after that, I ran into one of our information folks who handles a lot of our health related activities, she informed me that this happened to be a national initiative, which I didn't know when I was interested in the bill at first, but this kind of added to what I think is makes it of interest to our state. I think there are 34 states out here or out across the country who have adopted this legislation. That doesn't mean that we should, and but it does say that it's something that other states have come across and understood too. Before I walk you into the bill and into the standing committee amendment, Mr. Chairman, I do want to say that I appreciate the work of the Education Committee, and I especially appreciate the work of my fellow administrator behind me, the senator from Gillette, who worked to establish a little bit different bar in terms of what our expectations would be with this bill. And I think it makes it a better bill. I think it makes it doable for our districts and not nearly as onerous. And so, Mr. Chairman, with the amendment that was passed by the standing committee, and by the way, has that standing committee amendment been read in?
No.
Could I ask that that we do that, Mr. Chairman, please?
Senate File 82, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 1.
Mr. Chairman, the Standing Committee Amendment nearly becomes the bill at this point. You go to page 2, and I'm going to try to track that through for you. It might be easier, Mr. Chairman, if I just read along. Not later than the 2017-18 school year, all school districts shall provide instruction in basic cardiopulmonary resuscitation in accordance with standards promulgated by
Senator
the state
Lyman,
board. Yes?
Can you move the amendment, please?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 82. I apologize for not doing so. The word basic in front of cardiopulmonary on page 3, that second sentence, the standards shall require at a minimum that the instruction follows nationally recognized guidelines for basic psychomotor cardiopulmonary resuscitation skills training. Students shall be given an opportunity to practice and understand CPR and shall be instructed in the use of and made aware of the purpose of an automated external defibrillator. No student shall receive a high school diploma from the public high school without successfully attending training in CPR. We changed the date down on Section 3, Mr. Chairman, from 2017 to 2020. That allows the districts out there to accomplish what we're asking to do. Mr. Chairman, I understand that we don't often set expectations or ask very much out of our school districts. This definitely does that. And I was aware of that, having served on your education committee for the past 3 years. It does not, however, set a precedent. You might remember that not many years ago, this body passed a piece of legislation that was one of the first of its kind in the country. We passed concussion protocols, which, by the way, to this day continues to be held up as a piece of legislation that other states have tried to emulate. That was health-related. This obviously is health-related. You know, a final thought, senators, would be this, and then I'll sit down for questions. We live in a state that is completely full of outdoor enthusiasts. We ski and we hike and we ride horses. It's an agriculture state where we have, things to do with horses and heavy equipment. We have difficult jobs in very tough situations. And as I told the committee the other day, we have aging legislators. And so I just think, honestly, I think it's okay. We have enough resources out there. This is not very onerous, and I believe that this has a chance to really do some good. It's going to save some lives, Mr. Chairman. It's going to save money, and we're going to create a whole new generation of folks who can provide that bystander CPR. Thank you very much. I'll stand for questions.
Are you ready for the question? On the amendment. On the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion? No, I'm sorry. Senator, did Landon move it? Okay, I'm confused because of our. Are you all those in favor of Senator Landon's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 82? Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 82 is passed. We're back on the bill. Mr. President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Boy, everything my colleague from Natrona County said, I agree with, and I just had a couple of questions. If we do this in the schools, and the way I understand the bill, will it require some additional teachers, if you will, that will come in? Is it something that we might be able to work out a deal with a hospital that they would come over and provide that service? Just how we might do that. And then, you know, in some of the schools, we're having trouble. I'm trying to see how that they will not get a diploma, and how that's going to work in some of these schools. We're having a tough time anyway. Just want to be sure that, you know, we understand what we're getting into here and how it really might work in reality. I think it's a great idea, no question about that, and lives will be saved. I totally agree with that. Maybe a little bit more about the meat of it.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm trying to think. I think I've come across something on this before where there's been some volunteer projects that have been brought into the schools for this, not only for students, but for the educators. And as I recall, it was all volunteer, no expense, no teacher. Did the sponsor find that in some of his research? Is that already going on out there and already provided?
Senator Christensen, were you next, or did you want to?
Senator Anderson's up.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also am concerned about the no student shall receive a high school diploma from a high school without successfully completing a course. I would submit to you that there are disabled students in the high schools that cannot successfully complete this course, so I wonder if we could somehow modify that, depending on what you think successfully completing a course means. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, my question, I guess, is input from the classroom teachers around the state. Do we have a sense of if this ranks how this ranks on their priority list, understanding that they're frequently judged on testing outcomes, and do they think they have extra time to take away from their already mandated curriculum to pick something else up?
There's a committee of the whole amendment. Can we have that read?
Senate File 82, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 1, above line 1.
Senator Burns, can you...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 82. Mr. Chairman, this reminds me of my standard joke back when I was in the House about the Senate, which is about the senator who had the heart attack and the paramedics came in, took out 4 senators before they found the right one. Senators at the time found it about as funny as the senators here do. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, when I was reading this bill, it occurred to me that if we're going to, well, first of all, to address some of the concerns about if you having to pass or master it, I think that's addressed in the Standing Committee bill, that you have to understand it rather than master it. But back to the Committee of the Whole, Committee of the Whole Amendment, if you're going to teach these kids in high school CPR, it makes just as much sense to teach them the Heimlich maneuver, too. And as a matter of fact, more of the people that high school kids will be around are more likely to choke than they are to have a heart attack. So if you're going to teach them one, it makes sense in my mind to teach them another. That's why I brought this amendment, and I asked the body to pass it.
Sorry about that. Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to speak on and for the amendment. In mid-November, I was reading an article from my local paper about an elementary school kid who was choking on a cherry tomato. And without hesitation, this young lady's classmate popped up, ran over, started performing the Heimlich maneuver on her. He was able to dislodge the cherry tomato from her and has been heralded as a hero. And so if you're listening out there, just want you to know that your story really stuck with me. But I wanted to add that if you look up this article, and I didn't give it to you, I wanted to spare you the paper, he learned how to perform the maneuver by watching a video. So when we talk about what kind of impact even a small gesture is watching a video online can do, I just wanted to highlight that story. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Baldwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to put a little input on this. Part of the basic CPR, which is outlined in the regular bill, includes choking first aid. And I would also assert that in part of this amendment, it talks about the Heimlich maneuver, which is not a term that's used in basic CPR anymore. It's simply the choking first aid or choking maneuver to avoid use of that of the term that describes a doctor who now died from choking, I believe. But that would be the thing that I would insert here is I don't know that this is, amendment is needed. Choking first aid is part of the basic CPR class.
Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion to adopt the Committee of the Whole Amendment 1 to Senate File 82, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Chair is in doubt. I call division. Call division. Those in favor, please stand. Please be seated. 14. All opposed, please rise. I haven't even read the amendment.
Point of order. Mr. Chairman, you can't choke on this one.
I'm for the amendment. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 82 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank
I think I mixed both of them together.
Okay.
Yeah. The motion to adopt Standing Committee. No, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. The motion to adopt Committee of the Whole Amendment 1 to Senate File 82 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I want to get back to some of my colleagues and answer some questions. Appreciate the good debate on this bill. As to the time to teach this, I think the question revolved around whether or not our instructors feel like that's something they can work into their curriculum in either health or physical education. I've talked to several up in my neighborhood. They seem to think that it actually isn't going to be much of a problem at all, and it's just something that could be folded in. To my good colleague from Casper, I believe if you track that amendment in, that's exactly the concern that the joint education or that our Senate Education Committee had, and fixed that with the amendment, Senator. And Mr. Chairman, I think that that would take care of the concern that some students may not be able to take an entire course or whatever. Regarding the question about successfully completing for a diploma, there's no question that we may come down the road someday and find out that between 7th and 12th grade that we had a student or two who was unable to accomplish what we're asking them to do here. I can't imagine that a school district would not be able to be flexible enough to provide this 35 minutes of training. That's how long we think this might take. Again, we're not requiring the school districts to rise up to the level of a certification class. You'll notice by the amendment, all we're asking is that they have some basic understanding of what we're talking about in life-saving technique. Regarding how can the schools reach up to provide this, that's actually something that I did in my former life, and the AED that I aforementioned was actually donated to our athletic department. I think that's actually pretty easy to do. School districts can purchase these CPR kits, or they can go out and try to cover their costs with grants and donations of in-kind, either mannequins or the AEDs. I think there's an awful lot of options. One of the things that I think is very possible is that districts will be able to not only offer this basic training, but if they're going to offer that, they might even be able to certify some students. All three of the high school students who grew up in my household, for example, needed CPR training for their summer work experiences. I think it would be terrific if the school could help our students to obtain that. Right now, today, we have 13 districts out there teaching CPR in some manner or another. We have 9 districts that require it. That means we have about 25 districts out there who don't have this going on. And so, again, I think this is something that we can ask of our districts out there. We've lowered the bar far enough that I don't think it's going to be that onerous. But I do think it's going to change some culture, and it's certainly going to put some of our students out on the street with the ability to know more about this life-saving technique. So, Mr. Chairman, I hope that answers the questions. Be glad to answer anything more.
Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, one of the things that happens when we come down here is that we get presented with a lot of good ideas. And this is one. Is it a good idea that that individuals know of some CPR, at least know some issues with regarding that? These electronic defibrillators really have kind of self-instruction in these days. But nevertheless, what we have is we have a good idea. Would it be a good idea if all of us knew CPR, had some training in CPR? Absolutely. But should it be a law? And that's what we're passing. We're passing a law saying you have to at least be exposed to some training in CPR and now choking. We're not going to call it the Heimlich maneuver, even though Bill does, but. So anyway, here we are doing that. We also come down, we talk about local control. Well, we know, and there's nothing that prevents a local school district from putting this into their curriculum or somehow requiring that. In fact, if the state school board wanted to do that, they could make that a part of their standards if they wanted to. We've heard testimony that there are already a significant number of school districts doing this. So if that's a local priority locally, they obviously have the ability to do that. And so we just have to take a step back and ask ourselves, is every good idea, should every good idea be a law? And that's what we're faced with here.
Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, I had a lot of the same concerns about it when we first had the bill in committee, and we did take extensive testimony and received, as you all probably did, literally hundreds of emails in support of it. But we took this thing and really gummed it down a little bit, if you want to put it that way. I knew a guy that used that phrase all the time on the floor here. But if you look at the Standing Committee Amendment, we took out completing a course and said attending a training. I mean, we made it where it's easy. It's easy to do. Now, we can all say that we'll never use this stuff, but I can tell you there were two young ladies from my country, from Powell, that had been exposed literally to a little bit of CPR training, a very little bit of CPR training, which is about what this does, and saved, they were traveling, and saved somebody's life that went down with what they learned by barely being aware of what's going on here. So I don't think this is asking too much. I mean, just think about young people. That's going to stick with them. If they just go take this in high school, it's going to stick with them for their life. Maybe they'll use it. Maybe they'll save somebody's life. It's minimal. I think it's a good requirement for graduation because it's not going to take much time at all to do it. And it could be very beneficial. I ask that you support the bill.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the debate on this bill and have a lot of respect for my friend from Casper. He's right. Should every good idea become law? Well, no, but this good idea should. you know, we had some compelling testimony, Mr. Chairman, in the committee room from one of the local EMTs. And she told us that when they get a call and they're in the ambulance en route to somebody who has gone down with a cardiac arrest, the first thing she asks is, do we have any bystander CPR going on? And if the answer is yes, she knows that they have a chance. If the answer is no, she told the committee that I changed my mindset right then to the fact that we probably aren't going to find that person alive. Bystander CPR is something that's going to save lives out there. I think this is worthwhile, fellow senators. I really do. Thank you.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a little follow-up and maybe I missed it, but if we're looking at Red Cross CPR course, I'm wondering if they have an abbreviated course that talks about an exposure, if it's their standard course that you're referring to, or if there is some sort of a short course on this, or if we're going to be utilizing common practice from either the EMTs, Red Cross, or Medical Association.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm sorry, I thought that was the last time, the previous time, but I will stand up to say yes. The answer to the question from the senator from Teton is absolutely. I think that all of this instruction can be pared down. I think there are videos available. As I said, I think it can be truncated, but you could also set up a situation where some of your students who wanted to could go ahead and get that certification with just a little bit more time spent. And so I think you could have the lower bar, and I think most districts, I'll almost bet you, would like to go ahead and try to provide that further certification if they're going to be doing it anyway. But, yes, it can be truncated, can be abbreviated, and that lower bar is simply allowing for some basic training in this area. Hope that helps.
Mr. President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one other question. There's been some great discussion on this, and I think I know the answer, but I want to be sure anyway, is what about the liability side of it? If you're putting this out and it becomes mandated in the schools, and yet somebody, you know, there could be the way they applied it or what they did in their training doesn't work, do we subject the school district to some kind of litigation or or potential lawsuits, or how about the individual administering? I don't think we do, but I'd like to know for sure if that's an issue.
Senator Ansami Delton.
Mr. Chairman, the Good Samaritan laws should protect a person who performs voluntary CPR. And just to also address Senator Christensen's question, they say that they have children can achieve acceptable levels of skills proficiency in adult CPR in 30 minutes or less through a self-directed video-based program. So I think it's pretty clear. We should try to save lives for this bill.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, do we have any idea how many school districts are already doing this? I've got some information, at least from some of the districts, that they're already doing this already.
Senator Landon.
Mr. Chairman, yes. That sheet, I think, is on its way down to the good senator. But I did mention, I think we have something like 13 districts out there who are offering some of this kind of teaching. 9 actually have made it a requirement. But that leaves, of course, a little over half of the districts throughout Wyoming that do not have this training. So,
are you ready for the question on the bill? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises a report, they do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 82, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 82 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration. Division has been called. Please, everyone who... Those who voted aye, please stand. Those who voted no, please stand. Senate File 82 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 70. Will the reading clerk read the bill?
Senate File 70, Manufacturing Machinery Exemption Sunset Date, an act relating to taxation, sponsored by Senator Kinski, was referred to Committee Number 3, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass amended. Ayes, Senators Ellis, Kinski, Peterson, and Wasserberger. No, Senator Case. Senator Peterson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a due pass on Senate File 70, there is a standing committee amendment, and I'd ask for that to be read at this time.
Senate File 70, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 6.
And I would move, Mr. Chairman, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 70, and for further explanation of this good bill and the amendment, I would turn it over and give it to the good senator from Sheridan.
Senator Kinski.
Oh, I'm sorry. When he said good senator, I figured he was calling on Senator Burns. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Oh, great senator. All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have before us Senate File 70, and I'll give you the title, and I can say it once, but not three times quickly. This is the Manufacturing Machinery Sales Tax Exemption Sunset Extension. And the effect of this is to take the current exemption for manufacturing machinery from sales tax, due to expire at the end of this year, December 31st, 2017, and to extend it. The original date of extension and the change proposed in the bill are found on page 2, line 6, which states, in the original law stated until December 31 of 2017. The bill originally specified 2027. The effect of the amendment is to, did we vote on the amendment? We voted on the amendment.
No, we haven't.
He moved it. The effect of the amendment is to change that from 10 years to 6 years to 2023. And I would ask if we could go ahead and vote on the amendment at this time, and then I'll walk through the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Are you ready for the question on the amendment?
Chairman.
Oh, sorry. Senator Meyer.
On and against amendment, if you're going to have a manufacturer come in here, I think they want stability in our tax code. 6 years doesn't offer that stability. It's better than nothing, but I'd rather have 10 years than 6.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your Revenue Committee has discussed exemptions at length during this interim, and we have discovered that these exemptions should be reviewed, I guess, more ongoing than just 10 years. These sunset dates are a concern to your Revenue Committee, and things change. Industry changes, technology changes, situations change, and so that's why the committee voted for this amendment and passed that amendment. And would strongly suggest that we hold to that amendment. It's just good practice to every 5 or 6 years review a sunset and make them come back and justify that exemption. It's just good practice. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Kinski.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, the bill, as originally drafted between myself and the co-sponsors, provided for 10 years for a very simple reason, which is to create an atmosphere of certainty for these manufacturers, as my good friend from the back row had alluded to. I can remember I had a friend who was in economics, and he said, do you know the difference between risk and uncertainty? And I said, I don't, but he was going to tell me. Risk is when you flip a quarter 10 times and you know with a given probability the odds that it's going to come down heads or tails, and there's a normal bell curve of distribution, and so that you can kind of make a bet and know rationally what the outcome is going to be. Uncertainty is when you flip that coin, you don't know if it's coming down. You don't know if it's going to come down three-sided with something else. You don't know whether something other than a coin is going to come down. You just don't know. And he said business can deal with risk. It cannot deal with uncertainty well. And so in the face of uncertainty, business will always pull back from investment because you never really know what's going to happen at the end of the day. What we're asking these businesses to do is to maintain an investment base in Wyoming. As you'll see in this one exhibit that says it's a black and white exhibit. It's not the one with the color picture. It's the Wyoming Business Council Regional Project Assessment System, the RPAS. This is an econometric model that this legislative body has specifically requested to quantify the cost and the benefit of any exemptions that are granted to these industries. In this particular study, you'll see on page 2, the Business Council was able to identify 28 manufacturing companies in Wyoming out of 1,000 firms that have been identified, but they were able to gather the data on 28. The takeaway is in the bottom of the second column, $778 million of the market valuation of the real property for manufacturing, and then on top of that, you've got all the equipment and that they've invested in, and we're asking them to make... I am on the amendment. Thank you. The point of that is that we are asking them, the point of the amendment, thank you, is to create an atmosphere of uncertainty that they can feel confident in maintaining that investment base in Wyoming. Capital is mobile. Nearly all of the firms shown here have branches in other parts of the country. In my hometown, we have three manufacturing firms. All of them have manufacturing capacity in other states. So that when they're trying to make a decision as to whether they're going to continue to invest, they are looking at other states besides Wyoming. The 10 years gives us an advantage in that playing field. And I have a tremendous respect for what my chairman said about being able to review these every 6 years. But we've had this one in place long enough, and the business council has responded to our request to be able to quantify the cost benefit of this exemption, that the numbers are simply not going to change in 6 years. The only thing we achieve by making it six rather than 10 is to create uncertainty on the very kind of jobs that we have been seeking so desperately to seek in Wyoming to diversify our economy. On and against the amendment.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm rising in support of the Standing Committee Amendment. Mr. Chairman, testimony in the committee was that actually most of the growth and most of the benefit went to companies that are tied to Wyoming in different ways. For example, there's this thing in economics called the location coefficient. And all that means is that it's a number that can be greater than one or less than one. And if it's greater than one, that means the state has relatively more of that type of industry than other states do on average. We have some very concentrated industries in Wyoming that qualify for this manufacturing exemption. And I'm going to talk to you what they are. One is basic chemicals. That has a location quotient of 2.86. Petroleum and coal products qualifying for the exemption. That location quotient is 6.08. Pesticides and fertilizers, that one's 5.26. And miscellaneous chemicals, that one's 1.28. All those things are things where Wyoming, perhaps more than most states, perhaps more than a small handful of states, perhaps more than any state, has a concentration of that industry above what's concentrated in other states, Mr. Chairman. Why is that? Why is that? These are extractive mineral-based processing industries. They have to be here. They don't have any other place to go. That's the reason when we give them a manufacturing tax break, we're just letting money walk out the door. Mr. Chairman, those industries, there's like these what they call Wyoming Advanced Industries. There's a number of them. They employ 4,280 people in those advanced industries, and that constitutes one-third of our manufacturing jobs in Wyoming. Of those, 69% of the jobs are in those companies that are already tied to Wyoming because of our geology, our mineral resources, and you name it. If you mine something, and then you have to process something, you have to process it. It typically makes more sense to process it here than mine it, move it somewhere else, and then process it there. So they're tied here. And I don't want to overtax them, but I'm telling you, these tax breaks are not being effectively studied. We're giving tax breaks to people that don't need it. And that's why we need the amendment and the shortened sunset break, because this tax break... The testimony in the committee was it cost us $46 million last year compared to, and that's more than 10% of the taxes that these industries paid in total. So it's a big tax break. And we have to have the studies to make sure that we're giving the tax break targeted to the right places. We've asked for that information. We're improving our studies. But we shouldn't make this open-ended, Mr. Chairman. This needs more scrutiny. We tend to pass them right along, And that's what's attempting to be happening here. I support the amendment.
Senator Kinsey.
Mr. Chairman, I salute the logic of my friend from Lander and submit that actually it doesn't undercut but reinforces the reason to oppose the amendment. And that's for this reason. It's natural in economic development that you are going to start with the base of business and jobs that you already have. That's why manufacturing, this light niche manufacturing, is such a great fit for Wyoming. Look at where we are. We have this agricultural base, and young people grow up with welding, working with their hands, working on machinery. They go to high school. They learn how to work on computerized, numerically controlled machinery and advanced welding, plasma cutters. So it's a good fit in that regard. We also have these manufacturing firms in orbit that arose because of the energy industry that over time, given the ups and downs of the energy industry, diversify their product base. How do they diversify it? Why do they diversify it? One, as a matter of survival, because they know they can't be so abjectly dependent on the energy industry. And so the ones that are still in business have succeeded in doing that. Some of them are still too overly dependent on industry, but many of them have transitioned. I'll give you a couple of examples. But the way that they do it is they've got the trained labor, but they have to spend the money, they have to invest in the equipment necessary to transition to more diverse product lines. So two examples. There's a firm in our town that was a 100% energy related that another firm came into town that makes air handling equipment. It was a relocation from our neighbors to the south. They relocated with 25 employees. In the span of 4 years, they have nearly 140 employees, and they are continuing to grow. And they were attracted to Wyoming because of our tax environment, including this incentive and including the training programs, because economic development happens not with one tool, but you have to have an assortment of toolboxes, of which a 10-year extension on this would be a key component. But so they had some parts they needed machine tooled that they brought in from the West Coast, and they then subcontracted with this local firm that until then had done nothing but energy manufacturing. And I stopped in to see them, and the fellow said, you know, this is good fill-in work for us when the energy field slows down, but we really don't have the right equipment. We've got large footprint equipment. We can put this in there. We're not very efficient at it. Really, we need to spend about somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000 to get the right kind of equipment to do this work and to compete effectively with the firms that otherwise they would have sent this to. We also heard testimony from a former member of the Wyoming Business Council, board chair, I believe, and he was able to attract a company that is making high-tech orthopedics in a town just south of Casper. Where are they doing this? In an energy manufacturing firm that had experienced a slowdown but had the trained personnel, and they invested in a very expensive high-tech equipment in order to repurpose it from exclusively energy manufacturing to high-tech orthopedic manufacturing. They were able to do that because of the advantages that Wyoming offers, including this sales tax exemption for manufacturing machinery. I think, so with all respect to my good friend, the economist, I think his argument that a lot of this is just energy business we already have, yes, and that's how you diversify your economy, is by starting with the business that you've already got and then encouraging them to grow and to diversify their business. So for that reason, I would ask for these firms that are down on their luck and are desperately trying to retool to a more diverse product mix, please give them the certainty of a 10-year extension on this sunset on against the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Last question on the amendment.
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm for the amendment. And the reason being, I certainly can't deny what's been said. This is good in terms of attracting additional industry. There's no question that it helps the industry's bottom line and that it might be something that draws industry from out of the state to Wyoming to help diversify the economy. The trouble is we have to take a realistic look at our tax structure, our tax base, and consider the jobs in the industry coming in, the associated cost of their existence, and relative to the revenue that they end up producing for the state. And at some point, we go negative on that. We have such a positive tax climate because we don't bring in enough revenue to even support the new industries that we bring in. It's one of the problems we have. If you're not coal, oil, or gas, you're probably not paying your way in the state of Wyoming, Mr. Chairman. And so what we're doing here is it's similar to the idea of we want to increase sales, so we're going to cut the cost of our product that we're selling to below cost. And sure enough, that will decrease, or it will substantially increase sales, right? We'll slash the price to half of what we pay, and we'll try to make it up in volume. Well, that just doesn't work. And that's what we're doing here. It's a losing proposition when our taxes are so low that we actually attract new businesses based on that, and they're going to leave without it, and then we end up having a commitment to it, but they're effectively not paying their fair share. When we have a sunset date that's a decade out and businesses count on that, it makes it very difficult for this chamber to realistically address that. And to consider it rationally, consider what the cost and the benefits of it are, because we know we have corporations that are dependent upon it. I would consider it a substantial risk for us to draw new businesses into the state with a 10-year provision out there without us doing the analysis to fully understand what the costs and benefits of these types of manufacturing incentives are. We see these numbers, and these look like great numbers, when you see $418 million net return to state and local governments, but what we don't see is the other side of the equation. We add a workforce of 12,000 people. Those 12,000 people cost that community or those communities an awful lot more than that $418 million that was apparently generated. Even with the additional $46 million you don't pay for the services, it ends up to about $6,000 per person per year when you do the math. That's not even enough to pay for one student. So if they happen to have kids, we haven't paid for a third of the cost of one of those kids per person. Those are the types of balance equations that we have to do, Mr. Chairman, if we want to realistically look at this. By extending the timeline out and not looking at both sides of the value equation, we're doing ourselves a disservice when we do want to diversify the economy. For that reason, on and for the amendment, let's take a serious look at these types of equations, these types of math, and really do a realistic calculation of where that break-even point is for the state of Wyoming so that we can have positive economic diversification.
Senator Wasberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to let the floor know that this is my first time I've served on the Revenue Committee, so I'm seeing a lot of these issues. If I didn't see them on the floor of the House and the Senate before, I've never seen them in the Standing Committee. And one of the things that I thought was very appropriate about this bill is the six-year requirement instead of 10 years. You need to understand that we will have three different legislatures before they will look at this sunset again. And that seemed to me a reasonable amount of time. So we're now the 64th, the 65th, the 66th, and if any of us are here for the 67th, we will get to determine this. And it seemed a reasonable amount of time to me. And I have not had any of the manufacturing corporations that I represent in my community contact me and say that this sunset date is not okay. In fact, I think they really like the bill, and I think they would like to see it continued. So on in favor of the amendment.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think we got two timelines here. Timeline of the legislature, yeah, it's a reasonable amount of time for us to have three legislators look at it. That's reasonable. But the reasonable time period we're talking about is a reasonable time of business to make a huge capital investment and recoup a return on that capital bit investment. Now, if you go right outside of Cheyenne here, there's a little fertilizer plant. You're going to put a fertilizer plant in that, you're talking about $2 billion plus. Now, if you're going to get a $2 billion investment, and it could be right here in Cheyenne, or it could be right across the line in Nebraska, you know, those are the things that helps the business council recruit. Now, there's a lot of difference in a $2 billion investment, you know, as far as the return, as to whether or not it's going to be in this state or another state. And that's a certainty that the good senator from Johnson County was talking about. And those are the things, it's a timeline of business. It's not the timeline that's convenient to us. It's a timeline that's beneficial to business to locate here in Wyoming. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the amendment, I had the luxury of being able to walk and meet with the managers and owners of a number of these businesses up where the sponsoring senators from. And when you hit the ground and you see the people and you start to appreciate the length of time that it took to accomplish what they have accomplished and where their goals are at, it makes it a little more real than just talking about numbers and what seems convenient. And you get a sense of the commitment and the long-term commitment and vision that these folks have put in. And so I'd encourage us to be pretty cautious. This has been a 10-year turnaround. Let's go ahead and maintain what's been working and not put a burden on that may scare somebody off or discourage additional investment in our state.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the amendment. The amendment is to change it to 6 years. Now, remember, this sales tax exemption is for the equipment that you're buying to start your business. That doesn't mean you get exemptions for the rest of your time, your rest of your 6 years or your 10 years. You buy your equipment, you start producing product, and you start selling it. You don't continue to just buy equipment and buy equipment all the time. Any manufacturer makes that investment and makes a good investment. Now, there are times when you make another investment, as was brought up, but when he does that in that six-year period, he gets a sales tax exemption. But it does not continue for another 5 years just because he made an exemption one time. It's for the initial purchase of the equipment, the sales tax exemption.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, standing on and opposed to the amendment, first little clarification, it is for the initial purchase, but it can be done over and over again. If you open a new line, you get the exemption again. And I can tell you firsthand, back to my community, same as the good senator over in Johnson County, we've got some fairly substantial business in our area. And for a lot of these businesses, yes, they're close to the mineral industry here, but they can relocate across the state line, and we've seen that. We had one of these so-called exemptions that everybody fought a few years ago, and, you know, when they disappear is only when you find out when the business is leaving, you no longer have them. And we're struggling in this state on diversification right now. We're looking for anything we can to diversify our economy. And, yes, it takes a bit of an investment once in a while sometimes to get them here, but the rule of thumb is once we get them here, they like it here, and they stay here, and they do contribute. The long and the end of it is we can study them without sunsetting. If we want to study them and study the benefits, let's do it. But let's not break the bank as far as moving it from 10 to 6 and make that decision that we go ahead and let's put another one south of the line, let's put one west of the line, because they've got something we don't. We can study it. But let's give them that stability in their business model to give them the 10 years. Let's do it right. Let's take this one down.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a final word from Chairman of Revenue. It was a great debate. Isn't it exciting to be on the Revenue Committee? Proud of the Revenue Committee and the good debate that we've had. This exemption's been around as long as I've been here, and I know longer than that. Now, that's pretty good continuity. We have discovered on our revenue committee that it's harder to get rid of an exemption than it is to install a new tax. So consistency, we've got it. We've got it. It's a good practice. The Revenue Committee will review those exemptions on an ongoing basis, especially as revenues become tighter. With exemptions, we pick winners and losers. 10 years, why tie our hands? 6 years, it's good practice to review that on and for the amendment.
Senator Kinsey?
Mr. Chairman, briefly, just three points. Correct, this has been around a long time. Every time it comes up, we renew it. Hence, originally, I thought, let's just go ahead and make it permanent and really create some certainty, but I didn't know that we'd be able to pull that off. But as long as we keep renewing this thing, let's at least push it out to 10 years. That's point one. Point two is that we want to be able to review these things to see the cost-benefit analysis, as my friend from the Ivory Tower alluded to. So we'll come back in 6 years or 10. In the past, in my experience on Revenue Committee, we really lacked very much hard data, and that's why we like to keep the sunset periods as short as possible. But in response to prodding from this body and the Revenue Committee, the Business Council has been undertaking to use these econometric models to quantify the cost and the benefit, and that's what we have here with this three-page Wyoming Business Council Regional Project Assessment System Manufacturing Sales Tax Incentive Economic Analysis. This is precisely in response to these things coming up on sunset and the legislature going, well, we don't know really what it's going to cost us, so let's keep them all on a short leash. But now we've got the actual data. And without going through all the details of the study, if you turn to page 3, what you see is when they look at all of the benefits, indirect and direct, property and sales tax, in the last two columns you see unrealized revenue from sales tax, $46 million. That's the nominal value of that sales tax exemption. Because it's not just, it is a one-time purchase, but this equipment is high-tech stuff that has to be replaced periodically. So it's you buy a machine this year and next year and another new machine, and you expand your business, another new machine. So nominally, it's $46 million in lost revenue. But by the time you take all the jobs and the homes that people buy and the cars that they buy and the property taxes the company and everybody pays, you get what's in economics called a multiplier effect. They pay taxes on all these things, and the net return to the government is $418 million. It's a tenfold return on the investment. That seems pretty reasonable to me. But I say nominal loss of $46 million, and that's over 5 years. It's not $46 million a year. That's over 5 years. But I say that's the nominal loss because if you start taking away the tools in the economic development toolbox, you're going to see these jobs go away. You'll see that tax base begin to shrink. And so the question is, are you really losing $46 million over 5 years? Are you really losing it? Because once you begin to erode the confidence of business in the great state of Wyoming as a place to do business, you start losing these jobs, you're never really going to collect that revenue to begin with. Because these companies are mobile. They're global in nature. So what's different about the way we used to do our sunsets and the way we should approach our sunsets now is that 6 years from now, we'll be looking at the same data from the Business Council and the University of Wyoming as we are today. It's not going to change. These manufacturing jobs are good-paying jobs, capital-intensive jobs that pay a lot of taxes. The final and third point, again, my friend from the Ivory Tower makes a good point. At some time, we're going to have to completely overhaul our tax code. I just don't see that that's a rationale for shortening the period of certainty that business faces. Business is looking at making investments, and you say, well, we're kind of keeping that incentive on a short leash because the state needs to overhaul its tax code. I don't know that that's a concern to the job holder or to the employer. That's our problem. That's our issue. We have to deal with it. And I don't know if we'll get it done in 6 years or in 10 years. I think we need to create the uncertainty for the economic development, the certainty for the economic development that we've sought so strenuously to attain over the last 15 years on and against the amendment, which is to have a 10-year sunset period. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Question. Question.
Senator Case.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Let's be very clear. This three-page document that purports to be a study is not a study. There is no causality here. There is nothing that says what would have happened if the exemption didn't exist. There is nothing in this that says that. It just takes two data points, the amount of taxes paid and the amount of taxes that weren't collected. It doesn't say that more taxes were paid because it wasn't collected. It doesn't show that. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the kind of study we need, are studies that look at what would have happened with and without. And based on the information given out in the Revenue Committee, and I don't mean to use a prop, I'll set it on my desk, 69% of the employment in the advanced industries were in companies that are tied to Wyoming because they can't be anywhere else in the world because the minerals are here. That's the point. We're giving away something we don't necessarily need to give away. Now, look, I'm not anti-mineral, Mr. Chairman. I am very proud of those companies and the contribution they make, so please don't interpret this as being anti-mineral. But I think we shouldn't give tax breaks away when they don't do anything. We're talking about breaks on sales tax given up front at, how much is it? It depends on the local tax, 5%, 6%, 7%, 8%. On equipment that has long lives and is capitalized. Some equipment, you know, technical equipment doesn't have that long a life, maybe 7 years or something. I'm reaching, Mr. Chairman. But some of it has long lives, 20 years. And so it's all capitalized. It doesn't come through on the bottom line. Mr. Chairman, we don't know whether this does any good or not, but we do know that for 69% of the employment in the advanced industries, the tax break was, and that's over 3,000 employees out of a base of 4,280 in the advanced industries. Mr. Chairman, those were industries that can't really locate anywhere else. Things like chemicals, petrochemicals, coal products, pesticides and fertilizers, and other miscellaneous chemicals. There's no other alternative. Why are we doing this? On for the amendment.
Are you ready for the question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 70, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No?
No.
Chair is in doubt. Call the vote. All those in favor, please stand. Please sit. Everyone who was opposed, please stand. Twenty-one opposed. The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment 1 to Senate File 70 has failed. We're back on the bill. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, when I looked at this bill, the question I had to start with is how much is it going to cost us? I looked at the fiscal note, and I call your attention to the fiscal note. All that told me was that the agency that prepared the fiscal notes in favor of the bill. What I understand from the handout, and I want to make sure I'm getting this right, is that we are losing, and it sounds to me that's a pretty hard number. If you look at historically, we're losing a little over
$9 million a year on average in sales tax, and that that's, I believe, includes all the sales tax, whether it goes to the state or goes to the locals. And I would hope to be corrected if I'm wrong. And it seems to me the issue was pretty well posed. The question by our senator who's got a doctorate in economics, that you've got to look and say, not what's all the taxes you collect from these people, but what would you collect, how much would what you collect go down if you didn't have this exemption? And some of them, some of these places will leave. Some of them can. They will. I think might be surprised how many can if they really want to, but you've got to look at all the tax and business climates factors that businesses would weigh. And I think the real question, Mr. Chairman, is are we going to generate, it's really two of them, are we going to generate enough additional property and other tax from the ones who would depart if this exemption wasn't here, or would not come if this exemption wasn't here? We're going to generate enough to make up for that $9 million a year. And what are we going to do in terms of jobs? So I think that's how you've got to weigh this. I don't think that the analysis that was prepared is all that informative. I think it would be probably pretty expensive to do one that really nailed it down the way an economist would like to, because there's so much uncertainty. But I think that's the judgment we've got to make on this bill, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to get enough benefit out of it to justify a revenue loss of $9 million a year at a time when that's a revenue loss that's significant to us?
Senator Raffas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just to clarify, I appreciate the comments and thoughts on page 3 by my good friend from Sheridan, but the $418 million sounds like an awful lot of money, but if that is the all-in, including the multiplier for all of the individuals on the workforce, it's actually far worse than I thought. I had assumed that that was direct taxation, and it's direct taxation in the amount of $5,805 per person who's in the workforce per year. That's if that's everything, if that's the entirety of the wealth generated by the industry and those employees, then it's a far cry short of their fair share. It's not even going to pay for their roads, their water, anything else. There's not going to be any sufficient funds, let alone you start looking at the cost of education and the other total expenses per capita. That's the concern about the inequity. So when we're providing a tax break in addition to not paying the fair share, it's a concern. It's a risk to the state to actually attract more corporations under these terms. It's a liability if this is the entirety. And, Mr. Chairman, what I'm looking for is that full equation where you look at the total cost and the total revenue. All we see is the revenue side here. To extend for now 10 years this manufacturing new equipment exemption without knowing that is something that I'm very uncomfortable with. I hope the body will reject that and recognize that we're giving up state revenue under conditions of uncertainty based on an assurance of another decade without even knowing what this costs us. I don't think that's a good approach to our legislating in a budget crisis, Mr. Chairman, and I hope the body rejects this.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, on and against the extension of this exemption on any date. In a previous life, I was in one of these companies that's listed here, and it's in the top five dollars for equipment. We purchased that equipment. It was huge equipment. It was many millions of dollars, and we we capitalized it and took it over 20 to 30 years, depending on what the IRS would let us do. We never looked at that sales tax as being a big factor over that time. The bigger factors for us when we're purchasing equipment in Wyoming, which we were one of the ones that had to do business here, was, is there labor to take care of it? Is there labor that can operate computer-controlled machines that can do the work? Have we got that labor? Can we train that labor? And then the next thing is the property taxes on that equipment. The reason the assessors are keeping track of that is the property taxes are a bigger factor over that lifetime of that piece of equipment than the initial sales tax ever was. So that initial sales tax was never a big factor for us in investing millions and millions of dollars in these equipment. Sales tax was one time, property taxes are every year. So on and against the extension of this tax exemption.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On and against the bill itself, or this particular bill and extension, do you realize that, as was stated earlier, that we bring in these jobs, but our tax structure is such that we don't pay for to educate your children. You know, we don't pay. We lose money. It shows great that we, $412 million, I think, is the multiplied cost or the income level. But I want to tell you that oil, gas, and mining doesn't fall under these industrial codes. It only covers 31 through 33 in the industrial codes, and mining, oil, and gas are all under the industrial code of 21. So the only industry that we could bring in here would be an extractive industry. And if you bring an extractive industry in here, they don't get this break. But yet we bring in industries that we have to subsidize the education of their children, their roads, their sewer, their water, to the buildings and to their homes. But yet, the one industry that would make us some money doesn't fall under this exemption. So on and against the extension.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a lot of problem with the argument that we ought to judge things on whether the industry in question is going to bring in enough tax revenue to pay for all the services that people that might come in need. Mr. Chairman, I think if we follow that logic, that what it's saying is, let's run out everybody, from the government to agriculture to all the service people, and just have oil and gas and coal and Trona. Frankly, they're the ones that are supporting the state. They're very important to us. But if you follow the logic that let's only try to get industries that fully pay for all the services that people require, you're saying let's never diversify. And I don't think that's what we're down here for, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, on and for the bill. When you show up at these plants, these small businesses that are growing, you might see 30, you might see 60 people that are employed in a community, and they're doing well, they like their jobs, and they're able to feed their families, grow a family. You know, the idea that it's really only minerals, and I'm a fan of the minerals, but not every county, not every community has access to mineral development. And so I think we need to continue to look at diversifying, at supporting and encouraging new business opportunities. And in the first blush, you may say we're giving something away. But if you look at the long-term benefit and the ripple out through the community and how those wages are spent, you start to see that money circulate and benefit a lot more people. So I think we want to be very careful and not change something when Wyoming has continually been rated as one of the top states to do business in. This isn't the time to start shutting the door.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Still on and against the bill, and the idea that this is somehow about economic diversification, I think is exactly inaccurate. The key concern is to manage to diversify the economy, we have to have equitable taxation. Right now, all of the economic diversification is on the backs of coal, oil, and gas. This is certainly not either pro or against coal, oil, and gas. It's just a recognition that if you look at the total revenues of the state, all of the revenues directly for coal, oil, and gas end up at about a 15% net revenue. Taxation and everything else is around 4%. So we tax coal, oil, and gas about four times what we tax everything else. Coal, oil, and gas subsidize all of the rest of the economic activity in the state. And for us to continue tax exemptions that further exacerbate that problem when we want to economically diversify is troublesome. It doesn't make sense. We do want economic diversification, but with that has to be tax diversification. It has to be a sensible and equitable tax structure that allows for that diversification. We don't have that now, and this bill makes it even more difficult to achieve. These are serious discussions, and I totally understand that we want to do what's right to diversify the economy. Mr. Chairman, I don't think this is what's right to do that. We have to have realistic discussions where we look at both sides of the equation and don't just heap more on coal, oil, and gas. They've given us a lot over the years. They've paid their dues. For us to try and rely on them more just so that we can encourage new manufacturing jobs in the state of Wyoming at their expense doesn't make sense.
Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Appreciate the argument. I love it because it absolutely fits what I believe in. So for the last 40 years, we have been subsidized by oil, gas, and energy. We've used that subsidy in exactly this way to diversify our economy, to bring business in that hasn't worked. So now let's take the one thing we've got that may or may not have worked perfectly, and let's take it away. And what is going to come? Because it has had some impact. We have some manufacturers. It happens to be my town has no mineral industry. They're one of the beneficiaries of this. You take this away, you take away our oil and gas income, and guess what you have? A university, a bunch of government jobs, and absolutely no industry. And, you know, the hard fact of the matter is Wyoming's had a phenomenally hard time to diversify their industries. We've tried everything for every other industry. The only ones that have really worked, agriculture, tourism, and energy. We're not going wild on any of the others. Let's not kick one of the legs out of the stool that we already have and make it worse. You literally could make things worse. The flip side of it, once again, back to the kids we're talking about it. Are we going to start putting a form that says you can't come if you got kids in here? You know, this is all about all of us. And the ripple effect that goes through these communities is incredible. You take this exemption out of certain communities, you won't have employees that buy cars. You won't have people that spend their checks. And you'll go right back to, we're going to have a great big commons out there with not many people in it and a smaller base to tax.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On for the bill. This exemption, I think, is the diversification that we need in Wyoming. We need those jobs. We need those people. And we need those salaries. We need the shopping that these employees do when they buy their cars and clothes and food and all those other things that they participate in with restaurants that strengthen our main streets. We need the jobs. And we've seen some recent successes because of maybe perhaps this exemption, maybe not, maybe workforce availability, who knows the reasons. But all I know is this is one bullet that we can fire to attract these businesses and these manufacturers to our state, and why give that up? And so on and for the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to the couple of points, but one in particular to my good colleague from Fremont County, you've got a lot of industries here that can't go anywhere else. There's no doubt about that. And some of the mineral, but we do have, you know, some of the mineral extraction companies, you may not think fall under this, but in various ways they do. You know, for mining equipment and for certain equipment at a facility in southwest Wyoming, they wouldn't fall underneath this. But when you have different types of manufacturing that might make something like, you know, baking soda or into those different kind of products, they do fall under that. And there's a lot of times that these in discussions with manufacturers in my neck of the woods that are looking to invest, and that particular industry in southwest Wyoming that's big there competes, their major competitor is China, and we have to compete on a daily basis with our major competitor that is subsidized by their government. And we have an opportunity to upgrade our equipment, and all of these things are looked at: the cost of the equipment, the taxes, you're looking at the sales tax, the property tax, and there's a whole gambit of looking. And I know for a fact that there's one company that's looking to expand, and they're looking to entice investors. And one of the things that they need, they're putting all of these numbers together, crunching them, and then looking at the competition. So, you know, to say it doesn't affect some of the mining is not accurate, because there's a lot of different facets. You know, when you're looking at mining, and thinking of the production end and the product end, I guess, is, and when you have multiple products, that's where other companies do fall into this.
Senator Dockstader.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'll be quick. Everything's been covered well. But as I consider the list of these manufacturers and start thinking about some of these places I've toured across the state, these are in the smaller rural areas of the communities or smaller rural areas of Wyoming. And they also bring a sense of real passion for their work, for the companies they represent, almost a family-like passion for the product. I'd ask that we support the bill.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with favorable recommendation of Senate File 70, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 70 has passed Committee of the Whole. Senator Driscoll.
Mr. Chairman, privilege of the floor.
You certainly can have that.
Fellow senators, I'd like to introduce you to a group of ladies that have been very patient in the back waiting while we debated the bill. We have our clerks of district court in attendance with us today. They all work hard for us. I'm going to name them off real quick. We don't get to see them that often. Our very own Tina Wood from Crook County. And for the ones that I butcher your names, I apologize. Janice Sexton, Serena Lipp, Pam McCullough, Jean Tuma, Jen, I'm sorry, got one there right, Patra Lindenthal, Ann Sutton, Donnelly Boback, Kayla Carter, Diane Sanchez, and Cheryl Chitwood. Please join me in welcoming them. We may be short of ladies in the legislature, but we're pretty well loaded up on clerks of court.
Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise and sit again after about a 10-minute break.
Heard the motion.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, say no. Motion is carried. Motion is carried. Stand in recess for 10 minutes. The committee of the whole will please come to order. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee of the whole, the Senate resolve itself back in committee of the whole.
We are back.
So we're ready to go. We're ready. Just that's next bill for our consideration, I do believe.
The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 113. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 113, Felony Fleeing or Eluding Police, an act relating to regulation of traffic on highways, sponsored by Senator Nethercott, was referred to Committee No. 1, which returned a committee recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Senators Anselmi Dalton, Christensen, Hicks, Kinski, and Nethercott. Senator Christensen, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with an affirmative vote on Senate File 113, Felony Fleeing or Eluding, and to present this bill will be Senator Nethercott.
Senator Nethercott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have before you Senate File 113, which fills a gap that's currently in the law, which is unacceptable to the safety of the motoring public and to our law enforcement officers. The majority of the states in this country have a law for felony eluding a law enforcement officer, and Wyoming should join the logic and good reason in making it illegal to endanger the lives of innocent people on our highways and those of law enforcement officers. I will take a moment and walk you through the bill. So starting on page one, currently, right now, as mentioned, eluding a police officer is a misdemeanor, so this turns it into a felony. So the requirement is when we turn on page 2, which is really where the corpus of this particular statute or this particular bill is, paragraph C says, aggravated fleeing or attempting to elude a police officer is a felony punishable by imprisonment for not more than 10, so 0 to 10, a fine of not more than $10,000 or both, if, in the course of committing the act of eluding a police officer, one of the following occurs. So subsection Roman numeral 1, causes seriously bodily injury to another person. Subsection 2, causes property damage to the property of another in an amount exceeding $1,000. That value is based on the current amount for felony theft. And then the final subsection, Romanet 3, which is a violation of Wyoming Statute 31-5-229, which is the reckless driving statute. I think it's important for me to read what that statute provides. So reckless driving, the definition of that is just a one-sentence definition, and I think it's very helpful to provide guidance in this case. And it states, any person who drives any vehicle in a willful or wanton disregard for the safety of persons or property is guilty of reckless driving. So that's a very high standard in reality. The court has interpreted that language to mean the following. Willful misconduct implies at least the intentional doing of something either with a knowledge that serious injury is probable or the intentional doing of an act with a wanton and reckless disregard of its possible result. So that's how the court has interpreted that standard. So it's a very high standard. The absence of this law on this state's jurisprudence is just inexplicable to me because of the dangers that it affords. So currently you can have an individual who is pulled over for a traffic violation and chooses to run, and they go into oncoming traffic on the interstate at 120 miles an hour, and that's a misdemeanor. They endanger the lives of everyone on that interstate, everyone on that highway. They're going into oncoming traffic. And that's a misdemeanor. That's not acceptable. Not to mention the lives of the law enforcement officers that they're endangering by taking that action, that reckless action. So those law enforcement officers have to pursue and have to take either put out spike strips, contact other law enforcement officers in other jurisdictions and to create this really dangerous situation to all of the innocent people who are on our roadways. This also applies to those individuals who may be speeding through a residential neighborhood or a school zone while fleeing from a law enforcement officer trying to make a stop. So an individual going 85 miles an hour through a school zone at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that's a misdemeanor. And that's not acceptable, and that's not what this state should say. I stand for questions and ask for your support of this bill.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm curious about my understanding of Romanets 1, 2, and 3 is that each of those acts individually is a felony. And maybe I'm mistaken on the reckless driving, but I believe from looking through statute that that's a felony. So while the fleeing itself currently statutorily is a misdemeanor, the aggravators 1, 2, and 3 already would be felonies. So would this substantially change the flexibility of the court, or are they not 10-year misdemeanors? Could we get some more detail on how things would change based on a conviction with this, or would these be stacked charges where there would be two charges now, aggravated fleeing as one charge and then serious bodily injury as a second independent charge, or causing a property damage or reckless driving? How would this play out?
Mr. Chairman?
You know, can I wait just one second? I think Majority Floor had a question, too. Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, to answer the question, this is a new law on the books. It's currently not a felony. The language is an or. So if while eluding a police officer, you seriously injure somebody causing bodily injury, let's say while you're going in the opposite direction of traffic, you hit a family of three and cause traumatic brain injury to all three of the occupants. You don't kill them, but you seriously alter them for the rest of their lives. That would be a felony. Right now, it isn't. I want that to be clear to the body. Under Robinette 2, if while in the course of your fleeing a law enforcement officer, you damage someone else's property at a felony level amount, that's a felony. So just as if you were to go and physically destroy someone's house or their car with a hammer in an amount that causes damage of over $1,000, that's a felony property damage or theft if you choose to deprive them of that property. So just because you do that while fleeing a law enforcement officer should not make that a misdemeanor. It should be a felony consistent with the other laws on our books. Or making this a requirement that you are doing this willfully and wantonly with wanton disregard, and bringing in that requirement under Romanette 3 changes it for an individual who is simply eluding. So oftentimes law enforcement officers will see, they'll turn on their lights and sirens and somebody just continues to go at the speed limit. They're not putting anyone's lives at risk. They're just not stopping. That's not uncommon in a DUI-type stop where the individual just continues to drive around pretending like it's not happening. But they're not damaging property. They're not wrecking. They're not going excessive speeds. They're just not stopping. And so that would still be a misdemeanor. So that's important to understand the difference between that willful and wanton reckless driving versus just not stopping. I'm still seeing confused looks, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Majority Floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at that. I'm listening, and I guess when I look at this, I look at 62502, which is aggravated assault and battery. Under A, a person is guilty of aggravated assault and battery if he causes or attempts to cause serious bodily injury to another intentionally, knowingly or recklessly under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. And so there's also arguably two, which talks about attempts to cause or causes intentionally or knowingly causes bodily injury to another with a deadly weapon. So even in the event, I would guess that a car can be considered a deadly weapon. So I guess when I look at this, I'm thinking in the circumstance we've talked about, I'm wondering why aggravated assault, at least in the instances where there's actual either serious bodily injury or even bodily injury under the circumstances that have been described, why that isn't sufficient. And that's the same thing. It's a felony punishable by imprisonment for more than 10 years, for not more than 10 years. So I'm wondering, why don't the scenarios that we've talked about, why don't they fit into the aggravated assault statute?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think I was clear with my question, but it's similar to the majority floor leaders where, in my view, each of Romanets 1, 2, and 3 are already felonies. I believe reckless driving is also a felony. I'm not certain of that, but we can look into that, which is the Romanet 3. If they are already felonies, would this be a second count? So in the instance of what the majority floor leader was talking about, you have the opportunity to charge under 62502 for a felony which is punishable by up to 10 years. Would we then also be charging with aggravated fleeing or attempting to elude, so another count of up to 10 years? Is that how it would play out? Or would this be taking its place? My expectation is you usually stack charges, so I would expect up to 20 years at that point rather than the up to 10 years now, but I might be misunderstanding. Hopefully that's clear.
Senator Ansami Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the testimonies that we had today in our committee was that often the prosecutors want to stay within Title 31 if they flee a police officer, they want to prosecute under that, so that's why they wanted to pick up Romanet 1 and Romanet 2. Obviously, they are felonies on their own, and it could be that they wanted to layer it as well. But numbers, Romanet 3, to answer your question, Senator Roth, Senator from the Ivory Tower, it is a misdemeanor only for Romanet 3.
Senator Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In testimony today, we had a reminder of a case that made statewide news. I think it was about Thanksgiving of 2015. A car took off over in, maybe it was Mills, ended up out on the I-25, headed east, left the town, hit Natrona County, ended up over in Converse County. And there was video that made it around. And that video showed, and we got to see that video today, where they took off making their run for it, and they put out spike strips, and so the guy, instead of slowing down, he dodged over and went head on. And they had radio traffic, 120 miles an hour, going head on. And one of the things I noticed was he was on the wrong side of the. I mean, he was over on the left-hand lane with oncoming traffic, where people normally swerve to the right. He was in that lane, and I watched it, and I thought, how fortunate that there wasn't a head-on in that example. Came back and forth across the freeway several times, kept those speeds up, and they were finally able to get him stopped. But out of that case, with that kind of danger to the public, they only came up with a misdemeanor charge on the fleeing. And that's where they ended up. And so when we look at Romanet 3, that's where you look at the combination of misdemeanor language combined with this fleeing, and then you apply it to that kind of a scenario, and they had example after example of Wyoming footage when you looked at this and started to understand and appreciate the seriousness of it. And you can talk about it, but to see it from the camera, both out on the freeways, right here in Cheyenne, in our communities, to see what's going on, that's when you start to appreciate that. And so in that case, Romanet 3, it does take a misdemeanor, reckless driving with that willful and wanton combination. And then you talk about those kind of speeds and what it does and the threat. While nobody was hit, and there wasn't a head-on, and there wasn't big property damage, incredible threat to so many Wyoming people or folks traveling, clearly raises this to a felony level.
Senator Meyer.
Thank you. And in regard to reckless, I think it's really in the eye of the beholder as far as the police officer. I can tell you an old story. When I was a teenager, back in, I think, about 1969 or 70 or something like that. 45 years ago? Yeah. '09 or whatever, you know. Driving my horse and buggy down Lincoln Way. Actually, it was my old 55 Chevy. Okay, Limelight Polygrain, you know, 350, you know, Muncie, you know. Yeah, it was a nice little car. So, anyway, I basically go through the intersection signal, and change lanes in the intersection, and they cited me for reckless driving by doing that, by changing lanes in the intersection, drove down to the old place where they had chicken down there on the right-hand side that I think is a Mexican place now. And I got cited for reckless driving, $135. And so, you know, it wasn't from my perspective, when I signaled and changed the lanes, but the problem was is I changed it in an intersection. Can't do that, even if you signal. I didn't know that. But that was reckless driving. And that's the standard that they would apply to me as I drove down about four blocks to that place down there because the traffic was heavy so I could pull over in a place where I wouldn't interfere traffic. Well, if I went four blocks, they could say, well, he was trying to flee because I had the lights on all the time. All of a sudden, I'm a felon. You know, under this particular bill, I would be a felon. And, you know, folks, I've done a lot of bad things in my life, but I don't consider that a felon. You know, in fact, I don't even think I've done any felonies as I could probably think of right now. But, you know, I think we're going a little bit too far with this. I don't mind C from the standpoint that, yeah, if you've got these situations that are you know, really aggravated, and aggravated, again, is in the eye of the beholder, and that's your officer. But if they got footage and the guy's jumping across the lane and doing all of those things, I think you could probably say that's aggravated. I think you could. And that could stand on itself without bringing in an or that violates that. Now, if the or was an and, maybe I could live with it because they would be doing some of these things and they'd be driving recklessly. But really, it's just whatever that officer at that point in time, whether he's had a good day or a bad day, you know, or whether you've had a good day or a bad day as a driver, as to whether he decides you're a reckless driver. And haven't had one since 1970, Mr. Chairman. Hope I never do get another citation for reckless driving. But that particular day, in those particular circumstances, with this particular bill, you know, that could ruin a young man's life or a young woman's life.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, with great relief, I want to assure the body that under this statute, the good senator from up north of us would not be a felon. And now he's starting to admit other charges, and we won't cover those. But the reason I wanted to stand on this is that was the same position that I took this morning in our committee meeting. And I said, why, if someone commits a misdemeanor and then flees, does it become a felony? Well, when you look closely at this, as I was shown the light, up on page 2, line 8, if in the course of committing the violation of fleeing, then you do I, double I, or triple I. And so it's after you start to flee, not when you make a controversial lane change or, in the example we use, start cutting donuts in the intersection. It's after you start to flee. And that's when those examples of crossing lanes, of endangering people, of trying to play chicken to create havoc so that the cops give up, that's when it happens, not the example that was given because I, too, was worried that I could have been charged as a kid. But I found out that myself and the good senator, neither one of us would have, our history would have taken us to that level. Now, his further confessions about 1970 and reckless driving, I don't know what that's about. But we will defend him on his first worry.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I was a yes on this bill in committee, but I've had this really uneasy feeling on this one provision, and I think we're talking around it. So just so you're fully enlightened at what some of the discussions are in the committee, we do have a hole in our statutes. This is probably a needed piece of legislation, but my concern is we have the potential to capture people that we never wanted to capture under this. So the policy question that I'm going to get to here is how much do you trust your prosecutors and your judges? Because that's what it really comes down to. So let me run the scenario through you that I ran through committee this morning. You could have a young individual that for whatever reason has a license suspension or some misdemeanor that he's worried about, and because of youthful indiscretion, sees the patrolman behind him and floors it and takes off. And because this is an or, let's go down and walk through. So this is the scenario. We've got somebody that's got a little misdemeanor thing, and because they're not very intelligent or for whatever indiscretion, they decide that they're going to floor it. Now, they don't cause any serious bodily injury. They've not willfully and wantonly put anybody at danger because of reckless driving. But for whatever reason, they run off the road. They hit some piece of private property. Could be a fence. You can take out a half mile or quarter mile or 200 or 300 foot of fence. It's over $1,100. You're now a felon if the officer cites you, the county attorney prosecutes, and the jury finds you guilty. This is the part where I'm a little bit uneasy, and if you think that our laws are perfect and that will never happen, then you have no concerns. That's where I have the concern with this. Is it a needed piece of legislation? Absolutely. Could it create a little mischief if you have an overzealous prosecutor because the kid had a bad reputation and he had a misdemeanor and then he did something stupid? We make mistakes in our penal system and in our criminal courts all the time. That's my concern. That's the only one provision in this bill that gives me a little bit of heartburn. But I just wanted to alight, and that's some of the discussion we have. I do think it's a needed piece of legislation. That particularly property clause gives me a little heartburn.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look at this just thinking back of a couple of experiences that immediately came to mind as I was looking over the bill and the changes it made. A few months ago, I was reading a story from a neighboring state. A young lady had been out serving in her faith in a foreign country, came home, got ready to go to school. She's traveling through a busy intersection, a person eluding the police, came through the intersection, hit her and killed her, ended her life right there. And she had a bright future at that point. But there was no school, no marriage, no family because of somebody eluding a police officer. Another case, familiar with the publication out west, the publication called to ask about a young man who had eluded police and taken a car without permission, essentially stole the car, and drove it through a long stretch of highway. I don't know that the police ever caught up to him, but they wrecked the car completely. And in the pursuit of that story, for the publication, it came up that it was simply a misdemeanor. And the writer for the potential story, the reporter said, really, a misdemeanor? Completely takes the car without permission, completely destroys it, and walks away with nothing but a misdemeanor, nothing more than a traffic ticket, perhaps. From those standpoints, I could be for this bill. I could be for the bill completely. But I come back to that hard point. Does a felony fix it? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still confused on the same point, and I'm hoping that someone will clarify why we need this, even if we believe that all of these described events are a problem, recognizing that Romanet 1 is apparently already a felony, Romanet 2 is apparently already a felony, Romanet 3 is a misdemeanor. Now we've clarified that. So That being the case, I'm uncertain as to why we have to have the and of bringing a misdemeanor together with a felony to then call it a different felony, or in the case of Romanet 3, take two misdemeanors, put them together, and you've got a felony. I'm uncertain why we need that added to statute when it really doesn't change the ability to prosecute in any meaningful way. If I can get clarity on that, I would appreciate it.
Senator Nethercott.
Mr. Chairman, regarding the allegation that Romanets 1 and 2 are already illegal, that's inaccurate, and it's based on the law concerning aggravated assault and property destruction. There's a requirement of intent, and for aggravated assault, the case law on that particular issue is not clear. But generally, to be found guilty of committing assault, the prosecutor has to show that you intended to commit that assault, that you had the intent to cause harm, to punch somebody, to stab them, to do that. In this particular case, obviously the suspect's intent is not to cause harm. Their intent is to elude. And there is a fundamental distinction there for the prosecutor's ability to successfully prosecute the crime of eluding when it results in bodily harm, because there's no need to really go into the intent portion of that bodily injury. I can point out to you that there is some case law where a car has been used and they have been charged with an aggravated assault. And in those cases, and only in those cases, it was proven that the suspect or the defendant actually used the car to drive it at somebody, and you could show the intent that they were really using it as a weapon to cause injury and were intending to hit the individual with the car. And so a major distinction there between somebody who is eluding a police officer versus intending to cause harm. And so I understand what the good senator from Natrona County has said, that the term reckless is included in that aggravated assault, but the case law on this matter creates an unclear situation for the courts, and I would submit to you that the bill before you takes out that concern. So if in the event you are fleeing from a law enforcement officer and you cause serious bodily injury to somebody, it's a felony. It just is. We don't have to talk about why, whether or not you intended to hurt them. It just doesn't matter. You did, and the lights and sirens were on, and you should have pulled over, not speed at 120 miles an hour in the wrong lane of traffic. I do want to remind you all of the time that this law is being presented. As we all have heard in previous testimony this session, that the majority of law enforcement vehicles, they have car dash cams. And so most of these pursuits are on video. And so we can clearly see when an individual is perhaps a 19-year-old who decides to play a game with the police officer for a few blocks versus somebody who is more appropriately charged with a felony. So I just don't think that those concerns are merited, particularly in this day and age. Concerning the senator from Albany County is concerned about being able to be charged with every single Romanet of this particular statute. I've been trying to find the legal term. It escapes me right now, but prosecutors are not allowed to overcharge in that way. There are rules of professional conduct that prohibit it, and case law that also prohibits it, because frequently it's possible to potentially charge or overcharge a defendant. It's just not a realistic concern, even though potentially they could have violated all of these. And more likely, if you're causing bodily injury to somebody, you probably also caused felony amount of property damage as well. But that's just not how those get charged in reality.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just going back, and I just want to do some clarification. And also, I've got a question. Is first of all, in the one by my good friend from the Star Valley, where someone, I'm having a hard time why it was only a misdemeanor. In Wyoming, it would be different. Under, well, I mean, 6-2,
106 is homicide by vehicle, and you have aggravated homicide by vehicle, and those are both felonies punishable by up to in the aggravate case of aggravated, which is acting, which I think that from the description we're given would have actually, I think, resulted in 20 years. And so, yeah, a person guilty. So anyway, we've got aggravated homicide by vehicle. I'd also point out that under even then, and in the context of stealing a car and driving through an intersection and killing someone, 62101A, which is first degree murder, provides that if whoever in the perpetration of or attempt to perpetrate any sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor, arson, robbery, burglary, escape, resisting arrest, or kidnapping, kills any human being, they're guilty of murder in the first degree. And you could also go back if you want, you know, potentially you might think about an amendment, you want to clarify that resisting arrest might be an eluding. But I mean, there are significant penalties when you start to stack these things up. And it's not uncommon to see these things stack. And so I don't think anybody wants to condone the eluding. And we want to make sure that people get the punishment that's due. But I think I do have some concerns about stacking, and I want to keep us focused on the thing on what's at hand, because people can be charged with aggravated battery if they commit those crimes. It doesn't require an act. It's intentionally knowing or acting with indifference in a manner which causes is indifference to human life. I would suggest that driving up a freeway in the wrong lane is certainly a demonstration of that manifestation of indifference to human life. So we want to get there. I think we ought to move this bill forward, but we ought to take a really hard look at it to make sure that it does what we want it to do and doesn't do or extend into places that we want to go.
Question?
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the same section to address my colleague's concern from Natrona County at 62106. And I think it's helpful, to really understand these statutes to look at and read them in total. It talks about what a prosecutor needs to prove criminal negligence. And then if you go into subsection B and it talks about aggravated homicide by vehicle, shall be imprisoned but to the penitentiary for not more than 20 years. And they have a provision there in Romanet 2 of 62106B, and it says he operates or drives a vehicle in a reckless manner, and his conduct is the proximate cause of death or another person. And so I just want to draw that distinction between this language. That requires an actual death occur versus the reference that's made in this bill, which I'm looking at the wrong one clearly, but which just defines reckless driving. And so that's, I think, a really important distinction, is trying to capture those folks that are engaging in this conduct but haven't fortunately killed someone.
Are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Christensen's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report, they do so with favorable recommendation on Senate File 113, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no?
No.
Senate File 113 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the work today. Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion carries.
I recognize you. Stand up and say I move it.
Okay.
Good job.
Thanks.
Right there, sit down.
Reading clerk will please read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under considerations bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 15, do pass amended. Senate File 41, do pass. Senate File 16, do pass amended. Senate File 18, do pass. Senate File 82, do pass amended. Senate File 70, do pass. Senate File 113, do pass. Senator Bouchard, Chairman.
Senator Bouchard. Mr. President, I move for adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
Heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The Committee of the Whole report has been adopted. Do we have any standing committee reports or messages from the House? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Thursday, January the 26th.
Announcements. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, your joint Appropriations Committee number 2 will meet tomorrow morning, Thursday at 8 a.m. in Jonah Room L55 to discuss Senate File 144, Legislator Per Diem Local Residents, sponsored by Senator Bouchard.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your TRW Committee number 6 will meet tomorrow morning, 8 a.m., Jonah Room S27, to consider Senate File 25, Wildlife Location and Research Information, Senate File 120, Mentor Antelope Hunting Vouchers, and Senate File 126, Guides and Outfitters Penalties.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your Committee number 3, Revenue, will meet tomorrow, 30 minutes after noon recess in our regularly scheduled room, the Jonah Room S19, to take up files, Senate File 95, Early Retirement, Senate File 97, Tobacco Settlement Data Sharing, Senate File 83, State Spending and Revenues Public Reports, and Senate File 46, Appeals by County Assessor.
Any other announcements? Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your Committee number 8, Transportations, will meet in about 10 minutes in S-27 to consider the following bills. Senate File 57, Motor Vehicle Franchise Exceptions. Senate File 109, Auto Cycles. Senator Case, Senator Barnard, you're up.
Any other announcements? You heard the motion. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried. The Senate is adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, January 26th.